I'm Mary Parker, and welcome to this episode of Eureka's Sounds of Science. Since the beginning of civilization, meat cultivation has been a staple of human society. But with a growing world population and increasing pressures from climate change, it's time to start looking into alternatives and bring food science into the 21st century. One solution might be cellular agriculture, or the lab production of meat and other animal products. I'm joined today by two experts to discuss this topic. Stephen Miklas, a director from our Biologics Testing Solutions team, and Ramsey Foti, scientific director for Fork and Good, a cultivated meat company. Welcome, Stephen and Ramsey.
Thanks, Mary. Nice to be here.
It's my pleasure to join you, Mary.
I'm glad to have both of you, but let's start off with introductions so that the listeners can get to know you. Ramsey, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you came to be in this industry?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I'm the science director at Fork and Good, a cultured meat company in Jersey City, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I'm actually a dyed-in-the-wool academic. I've been in academic science for roughly 30 years. Started off my career as a scientist at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, where I led the basic research program in the Department of Surgery. I'm a cell biologist, a developmental biologist by training. And roughly 5 years ago, I was contacted by an ex-colleague of mine, who I'll discuss with you guys a little bit later, Dr. Gábor Forgách, who has started three companies. This is his third company, and he discussed with me the possibility of joining Fork and Good in 2019, and I've been there ever since.
What was the transition, just out of curiosity, what has been the transition like for you career-wise going from like an academic setting to more applied sciences?
Right. So, you know, the science is the science. Biology is biology, whether you're studying it in an academic setting or in a more applied setting, that hasn't changed. What was really different for me was the whole application business. I really needed to start thinking in a totally different way. In a startup, we really don't have the luxury of time that typically one would have in academia. Mm-hmm. You have to hit the ground running. You have to be very efficient in how you think about science, and always in the back of your head, we always have to think about the techno-economics.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. All right, Stephen, how about you? What's your background? How did you get into science?
So without getting too sentimental, my early career path was highly influenced by a revolutionary immunologist by the name of Paul Ehrlich. In the early 1900s, he described this concept of the magic bullet. And this is where some compound can selectively target and kill disease-causing organisms. And as it happened to be in the time of my undergraduate education, I was made aware of George Kohler and Cesar Milstein in the mid-80s winning the Nobel Prize in Medicine for the development of monoclonal hybridoma technology. So with these cell lines, you can clone them so that you guarantee that they're clean. You can freeze them so that they're immortalized, so that you can thaw them out and regrow the same stocks of material so that they're identical year over year from place to place. And they can be scaled up. And scaling up in biomanufacture is a big aspect of my career as well, where I started making these antibodies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign in the early years of the hybridoma field. And I spent 25 years developing antibodies with fine specificity to many hundreds of targets and up through and delivering these with targets of disease. So I lived that challenge of biomanufacturing scale that is moving a target cell line from microgram to milligram scale to many kilogram scales. And this forms the basis of our current manufacturing scale for antibody drugs. So one of my interests from this previous experience is the challenge of scale that is facing the cell cultured meat industry. Mm-hmm. There are several regulatory hurdles facing that industry. And as you know, the antibody drug industry has great experience facing these regulatory challenges for bringing highly complicated biomolecules or biologics to patients.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit later, how Charles River kind of fits into this puzzle. But and I just wanted to mention that I think it's very cool that you were inspired by this voice from the past, basically. This I just kind of had a similar epiphany when I was in college, of being inspired by an old scientist. In my case, it was Francis Bacon. And one of the things that he talked about was how science can be done by anybody. It doesn't have to be super geniuses like Aristotle passing things down to just be revered by generations. It can be, you know, technicians up. He didn't know what that was at the time, but that was basically what he was saying, was that people contribute to science in every way, including, you know, the so-called drudgery of just producing good data.
Exactly. And the creativity of our forebears in these fields. So the concept of a magic bullet, mm-hmm. It drove my whole career.
Yeah, that's very cool. Well, getting back to the topic at hand, for any cellular agriculture novices out there, Ramsey, can you give a broad definition of what it is?
Yeah, sure. It's basically growing meat without using an animal to do it. Mm-hmm. That's about the simplest definition I can give you. I can get definitely more technical if you like, but that's basically what we're doing, is growing meat without using the animal.
Stephen, could you expand on that a little? Because I know that there's like different ways of growing the meat. Can you give like maybe two different versions of how to do it?
Yeah, I guess the meat industry is mixing muscle cell and fat cell. Mm-hmm. And so there's actually multiple ways that they can produce product that bears flavor similar to that which we expect from hamburger or pork. And so mixing those together, growing separate cultures, and then mixing the ratios to create the flavor attribute, mm-hmm. would be one way that people are doing that. Another way is to take those cells and actually try to embed them into some biologic matrix, and like a scaffolding, mm-hmm. and to grow the cells in those ratios in the scaffolding. And then when they come to confluency, then that product can be harvested and sliced and prepared similarly to cold cuts or some type of standard meat that we would be used to.
Ramsey, can you tell us about Fork and Good and their method for lab-grown meat?
Yeah, sure. So Fork and Good started in 2018 by Gabor Forgach, who's currently our CSO, and Niyati Gupta, who's our current CEO. Dr. Forgach in 2011 was actually the very first person to ever taste cultured meat. That was his first company. It was called Modern Meadow. Mm-hmm. They've since moved on to basically brewing biomaterials, one of them being leather. And part of Modern Meadow at the time was a cultured meat company. So Gabor was able to generate things that they called meat chips. It was beef chips. So they were able to do it successfully in 2011. The problem was each chip they produced cost $100. So what I mentioned earlier on about the techno-economics being mm-hmm. very important, that sort of jumped up and bit them in 2011. In 2018, they rethought how they planned on relaunching the cultured meat project that they had in mind. And what they did to launch Fork and Good was to start from a totally different direction. Rather than starting to think about the science, they started to think about the techno-economics. Mm-hmm. How could they make the science fit the techno-economics? So that's basically what Fork and Good is all about these days. What we do is we design the science to make it as efficient and as cost-effective as possible. That way, at the end of the day, not only do we have the science working, but we also have the techno-economics working.
I love that. I love a pragmatic approach to these sorts of issues, because I think that on the one hand, the pie in the sky, you know, sort of dreamer scientist who comes up with all these new crazy things is so important, but then you have to bring that stuff down to earth to a point where it's affordable, it's sustainable, it's good for the environment. Like, you need to get all those pragmatic things into the equation for it to actually have a huge impact on society. So Stephen, you attended a conference a while ago where this topic of cellular agriculture was discussed at length. Can you tell us some of the topics that came up in that conference? What's the industry getting excited about?
Yes, I did. Actually, both Ramsey and I attended the 5th Industrializing Cultivated Meats and Seafood Summit in Boston last July. Mm-hmm. The focus of that meeting covered a broad range of topics spanning both R&D process and scale to regulatory guidance, investment landscapes, consumer acceptance and market adoption, hybrid products where they mix plant-based proteins with cell-cultured meat, and actual meat-based products augmented with cell-cultured meats. And as I said earlier, the mixing of different muscle cells with fat cells to achieve flavor and other attributes. So it was stimulating to listen to many of these talks. And what impressed me the most about the meeting was how collegial people were. Their overwhelming enthusiasm for the prospects of delivering these sustainable products that will achieve scale and check the box for flavor, nutritional content, and safety for our consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think we're going to get into consumer adoption, just because I feel like that's a whole separate podcast in and of itself. But it is obviously an important consideration with any new, extremely new technology in any field, not just food science, obviously. So that is an interesting one, but we'll get into that another time. But besides that, for both of you, what are some potential roadblocks for this emerging industry? Stephen, you want to start?
You know, I can imagine several different roadblocks. Perhaps the economy that we're in right now, probably the most immediate challenge. But in the long haul, cost considerations will be a resounding theme that drives this industry. And by cost, I simply mean things like the cost of the raw materials to make the product, the cost of production to scale, the costs associated with lost or spoiled product, costs associated with regulatory testing, and also costs for bringing these products to adoption. So ultimately, the market will either bear these costs or they won't. And we need to find a clear path for cultivated meats at large scale. So somehow it seems antithetical to me that a product bearing higher associated front-end costs will be selected as our solution to feed the masses. So we'll have to be, you know, focused on ways to creatively control the costs without sacrificing quality or safety.
Right. What about you, Ramsey? What are some of the challenges facing Fork and Good?
Cost.
Yep.
It's all about cost. And we've been working very hard to think about how one can mitigate the cost of actually making the product. So there are basically three pillars that we have to control. The first pillar are the cells. The second pillar is the medium that you need to feed the cells. Okay. And the third is, how do you actually manufacture your product? Costs are associated with each part. Less so with the cells. Very much so with the culture medium that you use to feed those cells. There will be economy at scale, but what I can tell you, I can share this with you, is that at Fork and Good, one of the major cost reductions that we were able to make was by actually using non-pharma grade water. Yeah, pharma-grade water is probably one of the biggest cost drivers of the medium, that and growth factors. We actually found that we could reduce the cost of that water tremendously just by using good old-fashioned New Jersey tap water rather than pharma-grade water. Of course, we have to clean it up a little bit and polish it a little bit, but we were able to reduce a lot of the costs of the tissue culture medium by going that route. As far as the manufacturing of the cultured meat product itself, we also don't use pharma-grade bioreactors. They tend to be incredibly expensive. So we've gone to using smaller bioreactors that are non-pharma grade. And the reason why we've been able to do that really has to do with the cells that we've generated and the medium that we use to feed them. So we're able to generate very, very high cell densities in a very inexpensive medium using non-pharma grade bioreactors. And that collectively has allowed us to really reduce the cost on the upfront end.
That makes perfect sense and is kind of, I think, the crux of the whole industry in terms of its viability going forward is coming from, it basically came from a sort of pharma perspective, but it needs to get into the realm of food regulations, which are just, they're different from pharma regulations because of how our bodies process drugs and food differently. I mean, there's scientific reasons. It's not just because food is more lax. So this next one's for Ramsey. Are there ways for traditional and cultivated meat production to work together to improve sustainability and reduce prices?
Oh, most absolutely. We cannot afford to be in competition with big meat, right? That would be the Bambi meets Godzilla scenario. There is no way that we would be able, the cultured meat industry could directly compete with big meat manufacturers. So what we've done at Fork and Good is we really want to bring big meat to our side. And how are we doing that? Well, typically when we make our cultured meat product, it comes out of the bioreactor basically as a paste. We have to mix it with other substances in order to give it better texture, better color, better taste. We can either go the plant route, so we can mix our cells with plant products. But we've also now decided to start mixing our cells with meat products. So we can have, for example, 20 to 30% cultured cells and 70 to 80%, let's say, ground pork. That solves a tremendous amount of issues. Now we have the color, we have the texture, we have the bite, we have the taste. But what we've been able to do with the meat industry is to give them an opportunity to reduce the amount of meat product in whatever they're manufacturing by 20 or 30%.
That makes a big difference, not just, you know, from their production level, but like most importantly, I think from an environmental perspective. It's like if you can make the cell grown meat in a more environmentally friendly way, then using that as just even some of the portion of the traditionally grown meat, I think that would make a big difference.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of interest from the meat industry in that regard.
Yeah, I'll bet. So from each of your perspectives, I think we've already answered this, but how likely do you think it is for cultivated meat to replace traditional meat entirely?
Do you mind if I start with this one?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think in some markets, maybe Asia Pacific, and more specifically in Singapore, the adoption of the cell-cultured meat product is fast. As a matter of fact, they already have marketed and approved a product for chicken bites. So Singapore also has led the way in establishing regulatory guidance for manufacturing and product safety. As you can imagine, allergens as well as other introduced variables could really affect the safety of such products. But other markets, let's take away the Asia Pacific. Let's go to the EU. They have very strong ethical pulls to reduce the use of livestock in commercial foods. However, they also have a resistance to GMO products. So GMO can impact cost of goods. They also would rather than embrace the manufacturing benefit of GMO, lean more heavily towards where Ramsey was just referencing, the idea of blending cultivated meat product, cell-cultured meat, with plant-based meats and supplementing real meats in an effort to reduce the slaughterhouse products. So this strategy, as you can imagine, is incremental and it will take time. So, but then you've got these groups of people going to be resistant clusters of adopters. So, you know, I actually don't really see with all these different headwinds, replacement as being complete. And I think 50% replacement as a global target goal over many decades would be fairly optimistic.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. To follow up with that, Stephen, if you can share, can you tell us a bit about some inquiries that Charles River has had? Have any companies reached out to us asking about services we can provide to help validate their cellular agriculture processes?
Yeah, on the European side, we've had a few inquiries, mainly from the Middle East and, and also in Europe for generating cell banks. These are the starting materials that are going to be necessary for the manufacturing path. We've also, as you know, Fork and Good joins us. We've engaged with them also in similar areas. But yeah, so there's a slow but steady trickle of clients that are beginning to develop the interest in our services for cell line testing and cell line banking. And again, as I tried to say earlier, the cell line banking is the immortalization of these products, providing consistency over generations, potentially securing the initial work that was put into generating these products. So we offer that under GMP. So we have some areas of overlap for this industry that biologics testing can definitely contribute to.
Excellent. Ramsey, is there anything else you would like to tell us about Fork and Good or about your own research that people would think is interesting?
We're always trying to invent the better mousetrap as far as cells are concerned. So we've opted to start with muscle cells. A lot of our colleagues have opted to use stem cells where they have to de-differentiate, re-differentiate, maintain the differentiation state, etc. So they're essentially turning an embryonic type cell into a muscle cell. We chose to sort of start with the muscle cell to make more of them. Of course, that comes with certain challenges. Primary cells that you can take from a small biopsy from the animal typically don't like to grow for very long or very quickly. Certainly, they would not be the cell line to start making tons of cultured cells with. So we have to do a little bit of genetic modification to them. We take a very precise approach and a very minimal approach to genetically modify the cells so that they actually perform as we need them to perform. And then, of course, we tweak the tissue culture medium for each of the cell lines that we make. Commercially available tissue culture medium tends to have, you know, a lot of components to them. Quite often, cells don't use all the components that are in the commercially available media. So we've had to find a way to determine exactly what our cells need in order to grow optimally. So we formulate our media ourselves. We don't use pharma-grade components. We try to use either feed-grade or food-grade components that we could buy at scale and relatively cheaply. We've eliminated the use of fetal bovine serum. We're currently testing a very promising serum-free medium for our cells. They grow very well in it, and we've been able to reduce the costs again 63-fold from when we first started.
Wow.
So yeah, we've sort of taken a pragmatic approach to link the cells with the medium that they grow with. We've been able to leverage biochemical and molecular technologies that actually can track exactly what nutrients our cells use in the bioreactors that we grow them in to further optimize the growth rate and minimize the cost of the medium that we're feeding them.
Wow. You know, it just occurred to me, and this is getting probably way off track, but do you think there's any chance of cellular agricultural technology being reverse engineered back into pharmaceutical grade for doing things like, I don't know, growing skin grafts for patients, or even, you know, the ultimate ideal of somehow printing organs for organ transplants?
Yeah, I think so. You know, we've had to be pretty creative with mm-hmm. with how we do things. And some of that creativity, I think, can be reverse engineered back into the biopharmaceutical industry. Ultimately, as far as biopharmaceuticals are concerned, the safety issue is paramount.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important for cellular agriculture as well, but maybe not quite as important as it would be in pharmaceuticals. After all, we're just eating the product that we're making.
Exactly. Yep. It is a lot. That's the thing that I think can kind of trip consumers up sometimes, is the difference between a drug that might go into your bloodstream or might be used surgically or something versus eating something and having it go through your digestive system. Like there's different standards for a reason. It interacts with your body in completely different ways.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And you know, we spoke a little about roadblocks. The other one I might be able to just throw out there right now. Part of the issue with cultured meat these days is this whole concept that, you know, we're putting something into our body that somehow might, since they're cells, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're genetically modified cells. So people maybe are a little bit worried that somehow these live cells can find their way into the body. But what I can tell you is, I mean, we eat foreign material all the time. We
Absolutely.
Eat genetically modified foods all the time. You know, nothing happens. These cells have to go through the digestive tract. They're essentially broken down into their constituent elements. It's never an issue. We eat cows and pigs and whatever else, and we don't sprout horns or tails. So I really don't think it's as big of an issue as people make it out to be.
No, not at all.
I would agree with that, Ramsey, that the whole concept of digestive systems and meat and protein and nutrition should put a lever against the, is this going to become tumorigenic, for example. But I think from a viral safety perspective, there are many known organisms and contaminants that can project themselves through the digestive system and into the host. So there is still room for safety. I think GMO is probably one of the least concerning. I think viral safety is probably paramount.
Of course, and that's where, you know, the FDA comes in and Charles River comes in. And so I think it's wonderful that the FDA is involved, and very important for us to make sure that whatever product we're making is completely safe.
So finally, what kind of manufacturing processes or new technology could help improve the scale and distribution of cultivated meat?
I think off the top of my head, we look to disruptive technologies that will help drive down the cost while improving quality attributes of the cell-cultured meat manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, I can imagine us evolving fully automated continuous culture manufacturing plants that wed themselves with this inline testing, so you can test and grow kind of in parallel. And these features, along with things like artificial intelligence, can help us predict production schedules and to help automate a process where it can support a 24-hour, 7-day production line with fewer hands, less labor force, where quality testing being a phase-appropriately integrated process will speed that production to grocery shelves.
Anything to add to that, Ramsey?
Well, I think distribution is key. What we envision at Fork and Good is rather than having like a central plant with humongous reactors, we're thinking more along the lines of a scale out where you have smaller reactors, but maybe a battery of them in something that might resemble a microbrewery. And having these microbreweries distributed strategically across the country to help mitigate distance traveled to market. And that could significantly impact environmental concerns.
That would be so cool. I mean, people do love locally sourced produce and meat. And so this would be locally sourced cellular agriculture. That would be pretty rad.
It's a great model.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, thank you both so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm so glad you are both here and sharing your expertise with me.
Quite welcome. Really enjoyed it.
Anytime, Mary. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.